Foundation here in the heart of Midtown Manhattan. You're in a historic show. It was built during the Civil War in 1864, and it's a vibrant congregation. There are hundreds of people passing through our doors on any given week. There's Shiurim here, classes almost every night of the week. And if any of you live here in the neighborhood or pass through here often, I really want to encourage you to come and take a look at some of the programs and classes that we have. We'd love to have you become more involved in the synagogue. We're so honored to host this lecture here tonight. Such a privilege for our shul to have the presence of and the opportunity to learn from our revered Rebbe, our teacher, Rav Herschel Schachter. And we're also so grateful for the opportunity to partner with the Center for Return. I've known Rav Kahn for many years now, and it's just remarkable the impact that he has on countless Jews across New York and beyond, connecting with so many neshamas, so many Jewish souls, and through the most beautiful way, teaching them Torah. I've had the opportunity to go and to give classes in corporate offices, and the work that the Center for Return does is spectacular. So again, we're so grateful to be able to host this event, and at this time, I'll turn it over to Rav Kahn. Thank you.
I would very much like to thank Rabbi Gideon Schluss and the entire Aderet El congregation for their hospitality and for partnering with Center for Return in the Yeshiva Light program. The Yeshiva Light program tries to bring authentic Torah scholarship to the widest spectrum of Jewish affiliation. Rabbi Schluss, besides being one of the most modest Jews I have ever met, is a true model in his service to the Jewish community. May Rabbi Schluss's future and Aderet El's future be bright and blessed with much success always. A little less than a year ago, Center for Return asked Rabbi Schachter, one of the greatest Talmudic scholars in the world, to speak for us at a yeshiva light. Of course, he was brilliant as always. We are very honored that he has agreed to speak for us again. One of the things that amazes me about Rabbi Schachter is his ability to take the most complicated Talmudic topic and reduce it to its elemental points so that everyone can understand. Of course, it helps that he is intimately acquainted with the entire Talmud and code of Jewish law. Without further ado, please rise, Rabbi Herschel Schachter.
Thank you very much. There is a law that any fruits or vegetables or grain, anything that grows in Israel that's edible, may not be eaten until we first take out truma or meisim. And the chief rabbinate in Eretz Yisrael supervises this. That's what the hashgacha is all about. In America, kashrus is much easier. But in Eretz Yisrael, everything that grows in Eretz Yisrael is considered tevel, and you have to take out 2% for truma and 10% for maaser rishon. You have to take out different separations before you're allowed to eat anything. Oh, I have to explain what that means. Okay. Years ago, the Kohanim didn't make a living. The Kohanim were busy in the Beis Hamikdash offering the sacrifices in the temple. So in order to support the Kohanim, in order to support the Levim, so God instructed us that whatever grows in Eretz Yisrael, whatever is edible, you have to give 2% of all of the food to Kohanim and 10% to the Levim. They were also busy in the Holy Temple playing music and taking care of the sacrifices as well. And then another 10% had to be used for other purposes. So before you take out the 2% that you give to the Kohanim and the 10% that you give to the Levian, and the next 10% that you eat in Yerushalayim and you give to the poor, depending on which year it is, so before you take anything out, you're not allowed to eat any of the food. So the Mishnayos tell us that this law only applies if a person owns a field and the fruit that grows, whatever grows on the field, belongs to him. What if you have a field that doesn't belong to anybody? That's what we call in Hebrew hefker. You have a field that no one owns the field.
Can you
Do you know what the Talmud is? You know what the Talmud is? The Mishnayos is the text of the laws written by the earlier rabbis that the Talmud is a commentary on. So the Mishnayos is the original oral law that was written down. Originally it was oral, and then it was written down. The original text is called Mishnah, and then the Gemara is the commentary on the Mishnah. And we call all of this together the Talmud, the text of the Mishnah with the commentary. The text of the Mishnah was written in Hebrew, in Israel, and the commentary is written in Babylonia, it's written in Aramaic. And the whole thing together is called the Talmud. So we have, the principle is spelled out in the Talmud, in the Mishnayos, that if a field doesn't belong to anybody, it's what we call in Hebrew hefker, ownerless, and apples grow on the tree, pears grow on the tree, whatever, one is not obligated to take off any of the tithes. You don't have to give the 2% to the Kohen, you don't have to give the 10% to the Levi. You can eat everything without giving any, taking out any of these tithes. So Maimonides quotes a passage from the Jerusalem Talmud. We usually study the Babylonian Talmud, but there's also a Jerusalem Talmud that's called Talmud Yerushalmi. So Maimonides quotes a line from the Talmud Yerushalmi that if a person goes over to a field that is not owned by anybody, the field is hefker, and he plants something and it grows, so whatever grows, when he takes it, he's obligated to take out the 2% with the 10% with the 10%. He's not allowed to eat anything until he takes out all of the hafroshes. He has to take out all the trumas and the maisas. So the question is why? The Talmud Yerushalmi doesn't explain the reason, and the Rambam, Maimonides, doesn't give a reason to either. So there are those who interpret on the side of the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, there are printed commentaries on the side. So the standard commentaries interpret as follows. If there's a field that doesn't belong to anybody, I have a right to grab it. Whoever comes first, kol ha-kodim zocha, whoever comes first, you have to make a legal kinyan. You have to acquire ownership by making a kinyan. And secular law also like that. If something is ownerless, so whoever comes and picks it up first acquires ownership. So the commentaries on the Talmud Yerushalmi interpret that if I plant a field that's ownerless, by planting it, I acquire ownership. That's called the kinyan chazaka. You become the owner of the field. So now the field is no longer hefka. Now it belongs to you, and whatever grew on your field. So one of the great scholars from 100 years ago, Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, that was the grandfather of the Rabbi Soloveitchik that we all studied by from Yeshiva University. Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik writes in his commentary on the Rambam, he doesn't think that's correct at all. He says the word chazaka in Hebrew is used with 6 different meanings that have nothing to do with each other. The words in English like that, there's a term for that, I forgot what it's called, homonym. Homonym, no? A word that has many different meanings that have nothing to do with each other. So the word chazaka appears in the Talmud, and many times that it appears, there's 5 or 6 different contexts, and it means different things. So when you plant a field, if you plant a field that's ownerless, you can't acquire ownership by planting the field. If you put a fence around the field, you become the owner, if you want to acquire ownership. But by planting, that's called a chazak in a different context. That's those who know the Talmud, that's called a cheskes habatim, that's a different thing. But that doesn't acquire ownership for you. So he doesn't, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, in his commentary on the Rambam, doesn't accept that interpretation. The field still is hefker. Just because I planted, it doesn't belong to me. So why does the Talmud Yerushalmi, why does the Jerusalem Talmud say that you have to take out the tithes, you have to take out the 2%, give the truma, give the maisa? Why is it necessary? Chaim Soloveitchik interprets that what it means is the following. The din is, the field remains ownerless. I don't acquire ownership of the field. But the law that the Talmud Yerushalmi is developing is the following. Whoever creates something, whoever, nothing can be created nor destroyed. You can just change from one form to the other. But in a certain sense, whoever creates something that didn't exist before acquires ownership of the thing that he created. If you take something and you make it change its form, even though the thing is ownerless, but if I change the form and it's now what we would call a panim chadashis, a whole new thing, I acquire the ownership on the fruits and the vegetables. The field still remains ownerless, but the fruits and the vegetables that I planted and they grew because of my diligence, because of my work, I acquire the ownership on the vegetables. And that's what the Talmud is telling us, that the law that if the fruits are ownerless, you don't have to give any trumas and maises, doesn't depend on the field, it depends on the fruits. So here the field still remains ownerless, but the fruits are mine, because I was the one who created the fruits. They grew because of me. Even though this law doesn't appear in the Babylonian Talmud, we usually decide all the laws based on the Babylonian Talmud. We don't really spend so much time, it's not right. We should spend more time, but we don't spend that much time studying the Talmud, the Jerusalem Talmud. So even though this law itself doesn't appear in the Babylonian Talmud, nonetheless we have a passage in the standard Talmud, Babylonian Talmud, that seems to indicate the same notion. The Torah has a law that if I hire a worker and he finishes his job, I have to pay him on the same day. Unless we made up in advance, they'll pay you at the end of the month. But if you don't say otherwise, the law says, a verse in the Bible, you have to pay the same day. Let's say you have a babysitter finishes the job. You have a painter, so the day the painter finishes the job, you have to give him the check or give him the money right away. You're not supposed to wait. What if I buy merchandise from a store? I buy an automobile, I buy television, whatever I buy. So there's no such law. It's only a din salary of an employee who did work for me, whether it's easy work or difficult, babysitting sometimes more difficult than other work. So whatever work the person did, the painter or the babysitter, whoever work they did, you have to pay on the same day. That's because that's what we call schiras poelim, to pay the employee the salary that he deserves. So the Torah has a special din, has to be paid on the same day. But if you're paying for merchandise that you purchased, so there is no such law. You have to pay, it's understood, you have to pay within 30 days. It's not right to dilly-dally, but you have until 30 days. So the Talmud discusses the following case. What if I take a chunk of silver and I give it to a jeweler and I ask him to make me a fancy piece of jewelry? I ask him to make a fancy cup, a becher, to make kiddush over, to make something fancy. So let's say, for argument's sake, the original piece of silver that I gave him was worth, I'm making up numbers, was worth $100. After he's going to make this beautiful piece of jewelry, a menorah out of it, now it's going to be worth $1,000. So it'll be worth $900 more than it was in its original state. So, and then we made up, I'm going to pay him $50 for doing the work. So is the $50 salary for doing the work for me? In which case, he's my employee. He did work, it took him a couple of hours, and he took the chunk of raw silver and he made it into a menorah, made it into a becher, candlestick, whatever. So I owe him the $50 as chiras poelim, salary for an employee, have to pay it on the same day. Or maybe the din is not so. Maybe the din is, since he took this raw material and he improved it, not stam he was a babysitter, not stam he was a painter. He took the raw material, he made it into a whole new thing. So maybe the $900 that it's worth more than it was before really belongs to him. We're partners now, we're shutfim. $100 worth of this silver belongs to me because I gave him originally $100 worth of raw silver. The $900 that is worth more belongs to him because he created that shvach. He improved it. We're partners, but he agreed in advance to sell me his $900 share of the partnership for $50. So if you should assume the second way, then he's selling me merchandise. A bargain? He's selling me, we made up in advance, he's selling me $900 worth of merchandise for $50. So then if it's Demei HaMekach, if I'm paying him to purchase the $900 worth, then I have 30 days to pay. The law doesn't apply, the halacha wouldn't apply that I have to pay on the same day. So the Talmud raises this issue, the Babylonian Talmud raises this issue, And the terminology that the Talmud uses is, should we say Uman, the expert, the mumche, the craftsman, who improved the value of the silver, instead of being worth $100, now it's worth $1,000, do we say he acquires ownership of the $900 extra that it's worth, or should we say he doesn't acquire ownership? So Rabbi Soloveitchik Jr., not Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, Rabbi Soloveitchik that we knew from New York, used to explain that the Talmud knew for sure that the craftsman should really acquire ownership of the $900 extra that it's worth. Because he created that shvach. He created that with his own hands. He was the artist who did it. The only debate, the only issue the Talmud raised was, if I own a house, if I own a tree, and fruits grow in the tree, so whoever owns the tree owns the fruits that grow. If I own a field, and something grows from the field, whoever owns the field owns whatever grows. That's in Talmudic terminology, that's called Arai Ashbach. Hakarka Shali Hishbiach. My field improved in value. So here you have, in a certain sense, a tug of war. The original piece of silver was worth $100. Now my piece of silver is now worth $1,000. So on the one hand, I should say, well, I own the original piece of silver. So now if the silver, instead of being worth $100, now worth $1,000, so the extra $900 should belong to me because I was the original owner of the silver. So on the one hand, you can argue the one who gave him the raw material should be the owner of the $900, and the $50 that I owe him should be for the services rendered as salary for the employee. Or should you say no, that since he's the one who created this new stuff, the new $900 worth of value, he created it because he changed the whole shape of the whole thing, so maybe he should acquire the ownership of the $900 and I'm buying it from him. So Rabbi Soloveitchik explained, the only time the Talmud had a question was, if there's a conflict of interest over here, I own the original $100 worth of silver, so that contradicts your right to acquire ownership of the $900. Because on the one hand, on the one hand, you should say, I own the original silver, so I own the extra $900 because it developed from my original silver. But everyone would agree, if the silver didn't belong to anybody, if a craftsman takes a piece of silver that's hefker, doesn't belong to anybody, and he makes it into a fancy becher, he would acquire the ownership of the becher, because there's no conflict over here. There's no two sides to it. Whoever creates shvach, whoever creates something that's of value, acquires ownership of that value. So that's Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik claims in his commentary on the Ram. He says that the one who plants in the field that's ownerless doesn't acquire ownership of the field. The field remains hefker, it doesn't belong to me. If I make a fence around the field, then I would acquire ownership. But by planting, that doesn't constitute a kinyan chazaka. I don't acquire ownership of the field. But because I was the one who created the fruits, the vegetables, they grew because of me, so I acquire ownership of the vegetables. The field remains hefker, ownerless. The vegetables belong to me. So that's why I'm obligated to take out the tithes, the tithing, the trumas, and the maisus. There is a din, there is a law, that if I engage an employee and I tell him what I want him to do, and he does the work, so I have to pay him the salary. What happens if a person comes into my house and he paints? I didn't ask him. Comes and he paints my house. I didn't ask him to do me a favor, so I don't have to pay him. For services rendered, I didn't ask you to do it, so I don't have to pay you. That's what the Talmud has an expression, Mavriach Ari Minichse Chaberu. The translated literally means if there's a lion who's about to attack your property, and the lion is going to destroy everything, and I'm a good Samaritan, I'm an excellent neighbor, and I go and I chase away the lion, and I impress upon you, look, I saved you thousands of dollars, millions of dollars, it was going to destroy your whole house, so you have the right to say thank you very much, and I appreciate it, and someday I'll repay the favor to you. You're not obligated to pay me. That's called Mavriach Ari. I chased away a lion from attacking your property. You didn't ask me to chase away the lion, so you're not obligated to pay. Maybe it would be nice of you to pay me some money, but strictly speaking, you don't have to pay. So the Tosfos, in a commentary on the Talmud, is bothered with Akasha. There is another Gemara. There is a passage in the Talmud again in Babylonian Talmud in the end of Bava Metzia, where the Gemara talks about a situation. I go into your field. You're away on vacation. I go into your field. You're away in Eretz Yisrael for the year. I go and I build the whole hotel. And your field, which is worth $100,000, an empty lot, is now worth $10 million because I built the whole hotel. Or let's say you have a field which is not good for building hotels. We're going to plant there. So you're away on vacation for a whole year. I go to your field and I plant things and everything is growing. So the Talmud says you have to reimburse me something. You have to pay me for building the hotel and you have to pay me for planting the field. So Tosis is bothered with the question, why do you have to pay me anything? You should say, thank you very much. The law is you never have to pay for services rendered if you didn't ask me to do the work. So why do you have to pay anything? So that's Tosis' question. So Tosis has two answers. They're not sure what the correct answer is. And it makes a big difference, halacha lemaisa. Bottom line, it makes a big difference. And one suggestion Tosis gives is the following. If the lion is about to attack your property, and I go and I save you, so you can say, I would have survived even if you wouldn't have chased away the lion. Maybe someone else would chase away the lion. I'm not obligated to pay you a penny. I didn't ask you to do it, and I'm not so convinced that I really need it. But what if it's a situation that it's clear and obvious that if you would have been there, you would have asked me to do the work? I have an empty lot. You have an empty lot, let's say. And I built a hotel so that I improved the value of your lot. So you certainly would have asked me to do the work for you. So if it's, let's say, Taisa talks about the following. This used to be, in the Middle Ages, used to be a common thing. It's coming back in style these days. You have pirates on the high seas who kidnap people, wealthy people, and they hold up their family for ransom money. If you don't pay us $5 million, we're not going to free this wealthy person. So the guy is imprisoned. He's held captive. He's a prisoner. And he certainly would be happy to pay $5 million to gain his freedom. But he never asked me. So I'm a good guy. I lay out all the money. I give the money to the pirates, and then they release him. So can he just turn around to me and say, thank you very much. Nice knowing you. Goodbye and good luck. Someday I'll repay the favor to you. The Tosis says they're not sure what the din is. They're not sure. On the one hand, one opinion in Tosis says, since it's clear and obvious that the wealthy man would have certainly been happy to pay money to gain, he would have been happy to pay $5 million to gain his freedom. So we would say, even though the services were ended without being requested, you didn't ask me to do it, but if you would have known that I'm available, you would have certainly asked me. You would have said, you'll reimburse me all the $5 million and I'm going to pay the pirates. And then the other opinion in Tosis is that it's not so. Whenever services are done, whenever someone does work for someone else that he never requested, you never have to pay a penny. You just say thank you. The only time you have to reimburse me if I built a hotel on your property or if I planted and something grew is because I created shvach. The property belongs to you. So on the one hand, since the field is yours, since the lot is yours, so whatever grows out of it or whatever is built on it, you should acquire ownership. That's called, on the one hand, we should say, Haroy Ashbach, HaKarka Sheli Hishbiach, I'm the owner of the field, so whatever develops on it should belong to me. But on the other hand, I'm the one who created the Shvach. So we're shutfim, we're partners in the value of the hotel that was built. Because on the one hand it should belong to you, on the other hand it should belong to me, guys, because I created the Shvach. I brought this about. So if you say it like that, according to that opinion in Tosfos, the only time you would be obligated to pay me anything is when I created Shvach, when there's a chunk of something that wasn't there before. There's a building, or there are vegetables that are growing from the ground. So on the one hand you own them, on the other hand I own them, so you have to buy me off. We're shutfim, we're partners in the vegetables or in the hotel. But let's say if I gain you your freedom, you were kidnapped by the pirates, and then they say if someone will give them $5 million, they'll give you your freedom. So I didn't bring anything into the world that didn't exist before. Your body was there before. You didn't have your freedom. Now you have freedom. Now they released you because I laid out the $5 million. But you can't really say that I created some new item that wasn't there before. So Tosis writes, they're not sure what the correct psak should be, what the din is. when the Talmud says, if I built a hotel on your lot, on the empty lot, if I planted vegetables, you have to pay me something, even though you didn't ask me to do it. So they're not sure why. Is it because we size up the situation? If you would have been aware, you would have certainly asked me to do it. So by freeing you from the pirate, you would have certainly asked me to do it. If you're a wealthy person, you would be happy to pay that money to gain your freedom. Or according to the other suggestion that Tosis gave, the only time you have to reimburse the other fellow is when he created some new thing that wasn't there before, like the one who plants in the field, that's Hefker, so whatever grows belongs to him, because he created Shvachman, he created something that wasn't there before. So this is a discussion in the sources that you have. This is number 4, and number 5, people have these sources of... Okay, so Tosis in Bava Kamma, Tosis in Ksubis, has these two opinions. They're not sure what the din should be. How do we paskin halacha l'maisa? Not clear. So in Shulchan Aruch, number 6, those who have the source in number 6, in Shulchan Aruch Yerideya, there's a section in the third volume of Yerideya, there's a big section that discusses the laws of charity, the laws of tzedakah. And as a subsection within the laws of tzedakah, there's a section about pidyon shvuyim, about redeeming people who were kidnapped by pirates. Years ago, this was a days of the Tanaim. In the Middle Ages, this is a very common thing. It's coming back in style these days. The pirates who kidnap people and holding up the family for the ransom money. So the Ramon Shulchan Aruch writes, he paskins la halacha in Yerideya, that if I went ahead and I redeemed you, and it's certainly obvious that you are a wealthy person, you would have been happy to pay that money in order to gain your freedom, you're obligated to reimburse me. So the Ramon and the Shulchan Aruch has adopted that position. You don't need Shvach Bien. Even if you don't have a tangible object that the other person brought into existence, I just gained my freedom. There is no new object that wasn't there for me before. My body was there all along. Still, if it's obvious and clear that if you would have been able to communicate with me, you would have asked me to do the work for you, you would have promised to pay me, to reimburse me all the money, so you're obligated to reimburse me. That's the way it says in Shulchan Aruch. You look in number 7, this famous Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, who died 100 years ago, had a very prominent student who was known as Rav Baruch Ber. I think your family is related? No? So, Rav Baruch Ber... Right. This is the background.
This is the background. But we don't have this
plan.
Some people have, some people don't have, because it's all in Hebrew, so I decided not to give it out to everyone.
We'll give you the sources later. Okay.
You have to listen carefully.
So, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik had a number of outstanding students. One of his most outstanding students was known as Rav Baruch Ber Leibowitz. So he writes in his sefer, in his book on Bava Metzia, he's very surprised to hear that his Rebbe, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, paskin against the Shulchan Aruch. That in the Shulchan Aruch it says that if I laid out the money to redeem you from captivity, you have to reimburse me. And he heard from his Rebbe, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, that he doesn't think that's the din. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik thought we should accept the other opinion of Tosis, that one is only obligated to reimburse the other fellow if the other fellow created Shvach Bien, if he created something that wasn't there before. So on the one hand, it should belong to the owner of the field because it grew on his field. On the other hand, this new guy, he's the one who created the object, so they're both shutzen, they're both partners, I have the right to buy you out. I have to buy out your partnership, your share. But if there's no Shvach Bien, let's say I read you a shidduch, and you marry the girl, and you're so happily married. And then I say, well, this is what I do for a living. I'm a shatchan, and I want you to reimburse me. That's my profession. So the Shulchan Aruch says you have to pay, even though you didn't ask the shatchan to arrange the marriage for you, Shulchan Aruch says you have to reimburse him because he's so happily married. We know that he would have been happy to pay a small sum of money to have someone introduce him to this night's girl. He didn't meet the girl on his own. He needed someone to introduce him. And Rav Chaim Soloveitchik thought that we shouldn't paskin like that. He thought the only time you have to pay the person who did the work for me that I never asked him to do is only if he created some shvach bien. This is why Rav Chaim Soloveitchik understood that Talmud Yerushalmi, the passage that whoever plants in a field that's ownerless, The field remains ownerless. By planting, you don't acquire ownership of the field, but because you created the fruits grew because of you, so you acquire ownership of the fruits. The fruits will not be hefker. The field will remain hefker, ownerless, but the fruits will not be ownerless. Rav Soloveitchik used to point out that Rashi, in his commentary on Chumash, for those who have these sources, it's number 8, Rashi comments on the Pasuk. The Chumash refers to God as Konei Shamayim Ba'aretz, a biblical expression. What does the verb mean, Konei Shamayim Ba'aretz? So Rashi has two translations, and he says they're interconnected. Konei means that God created the world out of nothing, and Konei means he acquired ownership of the world. Because God created the whole world, that's why he became the owner of the whole world. So that's the principle that Rav Chaim Soloveitchik is developing. He says that if a human being, we can't create from nothing, we can't create yesh meyayim, we make yesh meyesh. But still, if I plant something in the field that's hefker, or if I plant something in your field, so if I plant in the field that's ownerless, I own all of the fruits. If I plant in the field that belongs to someone else, or I improve here, you give me the raw material of the silver, and I make a menorah out of it, and now instead of being worth $100, it's worth $1,000. So the extra value, it's a whole new thing that you have now. I'm a shutif, I own part of that thing. Whoever creates some shvach acquires ownership of that shvach. So Rav Soloveitchik continued to point out number 9 in the sources. The Rambam, Maimonides, quotes a passage from the Talmud that we study in yeshivas. So one year we study by one Rebbe, next year we study by another Rebbe, next year a third Rebbe, a fourth Rebbe. Every year we move on from one Rebbe to the other. If a person really studied many years by one person, by one rabbi, and that rabbi is what we call his Rebbe Muvak, he's the one who made him into a Torah personality, so then Maimonides quotes an expression from the Talmud, any services, years ago there was slavery. Lincoln freed the slaves, so we don't have any slavery anymore. But in the days of the Bible, in the days of the Talmud, until recently, until Lincoln freed the slaves, there were slaves here in America. He said it was built in during the Civil War. So there was an institution of slavery. So that Maimonides writes an expression, any services that a slave is obligated to do for his master, to wash the dishes, to wash the windows, to paint, to do whatever, to carry my suitcases, any services that a slave is obligated to do for his master, a student is obligated to do for his Rebbe, if the Rebbe had such an influence on him that he made him into a Torah personality. What kind of a law is this? Why, the student becomes a slave to the Rebbe? How did the rabbi acquire ownership of the student? So Rabbi Soloveitchik said, it's the same as the raw material. If I give you the $100 worth of silver, and you make it into a fancy menorah, you make it into a becher, so instead of being worth $100, now it's worth $1,000. It's a whole new thing. Rabbi Soloveitchik thought that that's the meaning over here. But when I came to study by you in the beginning, I was a human being. Now you made me into a whole Torah personality, which I wasn't before. So you acquire a chunk of ownership in me. I owned $100 before, and the extra $900, on the one hand, should belong to me because I started off, it developed in me. So that's Aroy Ashbach, the original me is me. But on the other hand, since you're the one who created this improvement, so you become a shutor, you become a part owner of the student, so that's why the student, in a certain sense, has the status of a slave with respect to the Rebbe. So this whole discussion that we had so far, this is regarding ownership on tangible items. The fellow planted something in a field and the vegetables grow. Or I gave a piece of silver to an artist, to a jeweler, and he makes a fancy piece of jewelry out of it. So the extra value, it's a whole new thing. So the extra thing belongs to the jeweler, to the one, the artist, the expert who did it. What if a person comes up with a niggun? He composes a song, or he develops a whole program for a computer, and it makes business easier, makes it much easier to do your business. You have this whole system on the computer. Or a person writes a book, and the book has some fantastic ideas in it. So you can't really say that there's ownership on the idea. It's an intangible object. So the rabbis 150 years ago, felt that we have to have copyright laws. Api halacha, what do you mean copyright laws? You came up with the idea, so therefore you own the idea. An idea is not a tangible thing. So they said, biblically, min ha-Torah, you can only own tangible objects. I own a field, I own a lectern, I own a jacket, I own an object that you can touch. Davar she'yesh bo mamash, a tangible object. There's no such thing biblically as owning an idea. But rabbinically, that's what the Rabbanim in the middle of the 1800s came up with that idea. They said, whoever comes up with a chiddush, he comes up with a new idea, owns that idea, and no one else has a right to steal it from him. What exactly do you mean he owns the idea? So a fellow writes a whole fantastic book, and he says he doesn't want to share his ideas with anybody else. He's not interested in making money on the idea. He says, "Gamli gamlach lo yeh. I don't want to make any money on the idea." He comes up with a new system for a computer that makes business much easier. He's not interested in making money, and he doesn't want you to make money on his idea either. So we say that's ridiculous. He doesn't own the idea to the extent, if I own furniture, let's say, I own a big apartment, I own a lot of furniture, and I have so many pieces of furniture, if you'll take 20 chairs, I won't realize that anything is missing. I have 1,000 chairs. I don't have so many people who are going to use the 1,000 chairs. So still, the law is, if I own the chairs, it's a tangible object, so I have ownership on it. So somebody steals one chair, even though I'll never realize that it's missing, he's considered a ganav. He stole a chair, so he's a ganav. But if I have an idea, and the rabbis came up with this chiddush that midrabbanan, we declare that there is ownership on intellectual property, it's considered that I own that idea. Doesn't mean I own the idea, I have a right to say, gamli gamloch lo yeh. I don't want to make money on it, and I don't want anybody else to make money on it either. No, we say, you own the idea, midrabbanan, rabbinically, you felt you have to make a takana. You own the idea with respect to the right to making money on it. Where do you have such an idea? Is there such a concept? There's a concept. I own a house. I bought the house. It's mine. I bought the house with my wife, so it's on my wife, my name and my wife's name. I have a partnership. 50-50. Half of the house is mine. Half of the house is my wife's. The Talmud says there is such a thing as ownership with respect to something. Let's say you own a field. So whatever grows in the field belongs to you. What if you want to sell me whatever is going to grow in the year 2015? So it didn't grow yet. You didn't plant it yet. So that's the Talmud calls that a davar shelo ba'aliyon. You can't sell something that you don't own yet. It didn't grow yet. So you can't sell it. But if you want to make such a deal, so the Talmud says, sell him the field. The field does exist. Sell the field with respect to whatever will grow in the year 2015. That's legitimate. If the thing that I'm selling is the field does exist. The with respect to doesn't exist yet. I'm selling the field with respect to whatever fruits will grow in the year 2015. So that doesn't bother me, the fact that it didn't grow yet. But the field is here now, so that you're selling a davar shelo ba'aliyon. I'm selling the field that does exist now. So there is such a thing as, I own the field with respect to the fruits that are going to grow in the year 2015. There is such a thing. You can own something. You can own something with respect to one aspect, with respect to one detail. So here, in the sources, source number 10, this is a famous comment on the side of...
What's the reason that Talmud doesn't allow selling future sales? Is it to do with interest?
No. Not that the Talmud doesn't allow, it simply doesn't take effect. You can only make a sale on something that exists.
I mean, in the secular world, you can sell something that in 2015, I'm going to take that. I can sell now something that in 2015 is going to be producing value. So why in the Jewish world is that not something that...
If it doesn't exist yet, so you can't make a kinyan, you can't make a legal acquisition on something that doesn't exist.
And if I write a document,
also not. Doesn't, if the thing doesn't exist yet. The fruits that are going to grow in the year 2015, let's say someone's wife is expecting a baby and the doctor says it's going to be a girl. I fell in love with your daughter. She wasn't born yet. I want to marry your daughter. So I give you a ring and I say, I want to marry your daughter. So the Talmud says the girl wasn't born yet. So you can't marry the girl who wasn't born yet. But let's say a man This you have, let's say, a person wants to gain citizenship in the United States. He's a foreigner. So he marries someone, he marries a girl who's a citizen in the United States, but he's not really interested in living with the girl. She agrees to marry him just in order to gain citizenship. Probably not legal, probably not permissible, but a lot of people do it. So let's say he'll marry the girl, and then he's going to give her a divorce, but the girl's afraid he may not give her a divorce. So he'll write the bill of divorce before he marries her. He'll give her the bill of divorce, and he says in the document, this is to divorce you. The week after we get married, you should hereby be divorced. And the Talmud says it's no good. She's not married to you yet. You can't divorce the girl whom you didn't marry yet. You can't marry the girl who wasn't born yet. You can't sell the field that, you can't sell the fruits. Let's say I'm negotiating to buy the Brooklyn Bridge. Mr. Bloomberg is trying to auction off the Brooklyn Bridge. I think I stand a good chance of buying the, so I sell you the Brooklyn Bridge, but I didn't acquire ownership yet. So even if later I do acquire ownership, but at the time that I made the sale to you, it didn't belong to me yet. So you can't make a kinyan, you can't make any, transaction on something that doesn't belong to you or that doesn't exist yet. That's called Dovah Shelo Baliyon. You can't make a kinyan on a non-existent thing. In Shulchan Aruch it says that if the minhag hamedina, if the common practice in this country is that you can, so then we follow, it's a kinyan according to the minhag hamedina. But if there's no minhag one way or the other, then the halacha says that it doesn't take effect.
Okay, but to answer the question, yes. What you're saying, it's like the author is doing business, say you can sell the right, you buy from me.
Right. So that's, future, right? So it says in Shulchan Aruch, if you have a clear-cut minhag hamedina, which in America you certainly have, so then halacha recognizes that kinyan midrabbana. Min haTorah, biblically, it doesn't exist. But midrabbana, rabbinically, we recognize the kinyan, the acquisition of the ownership, in accordance with the practice of the country. Yes? Prenuptial agreement just has two parts to it. One part, right now the boy and the girl are lovey-dovey and they can't foresee they're going to have any dispute. What happens is if later on there's going to be a problem, so a lot of times they'll waste a few years till they determine which Beth Din should have jurisdiction on them. So rather than have them waste 3 years of their lives, they make an agreement now. Now they're still lovey-dovey with each other, so they agree in case there'll be any dispute, this particular Beth Din should have jurisdiction, so there's nothing to discuss later. So that's one document. That's a prenuptial. We already decide in advance, in case there be a dispute regarding the marriage, which Beth Din should have jurisdiction. Then the other document, that's the prenuptial agreement, says in the event that the Beth Din of our choice will determine that the husband should have given his wife a divorce, he was unfair to his wife, he was mistreating his wife, whatever, and if the Beth Din will determine that he really should divorce his wife, so he obligates himself to pay his wife $1,000 a week from the time that Bezin declares he should have given his wife a get, $1,000 a week until he finally gives it a get. So this will encourage the husband. The husband is obligated to support his wife. To support his wife to what extent? The wife can say, I want to eat out breakfast, lunch, and supper in the most expensive restaurant in New York. And the husband is obligated to put his wife up in an apartment. She says she wants to live in the most expensive apartment in New York City. It can cost him $1 million a week. So that's for the millionaires. Okay, some of them do spend $1 million a week. So if the fellow agrees, he can agree to spend $1,000 a week on his wife. It's not so unreasonable. $1,000 a week, $50,000 a year is not that much money. But if you feel that that'll be sufficient to encourage the husband to give the get, so the husband should write, in the event that the Beth Din of our choice, that we both determine that Beth Din should have jurisdiction. If that Beth Din will determine that I will be unfair sometime in the future to you, and I should really give you a get, so from the time that they think I'm acting improperly, I hereby obligate myself to give you $1,000 a week or $1,500 a week for support. If he's going to say $1 million a week, so that's not binding, that's a joke. Because right now they're lovey-dovey, he thought it's never going to happen. That's what we call asmachta. A person agrees to an obligation, not a condition, he thinks that it's never going to come to fruition, so then he's not obligated to pay. So if he writes a whole exaggerated amount, $1 million a week, you know he doesn't have $1 million to pay, so that wouldn't be binding. But if he writes a high amount, that's not so ridiculous, but for him it's a lot of money. $1,000, $1,500 a week, and not so crazy. It can cost $1,500 a week. So this will encourage him to give the get in a reasonable amount of time. So that's a different thing. That's not, there is no Dovash Labaliyonim over there. They're going to get married, and he says, in the event that there'll be a dispute, we agree already, let's say people enter into a business agreement, and then they write in the contract, in case there'll be any dispute, we want it to be determined, we want it to be decided by a particular Beth Din. If both parties are Jewish, they're not supposed to go to secular court. So they write in advance, in case there'll be a dispute, in case there'll be any argument, we agree in advance to go to this Beth Din. So that's one of the conditions of the agreement. So in marriage also, they agree to get married, and they say, in case there'll be a dispute regarding the marriage, any details, we already make up now that this and this person should have the final say. So that's legitimate. And the second step is also legitimate. There is no Dovash Lo Bal Yolam over there. There's nothing that didn't come into existence yet. He says, in the event that I marry you, okay, so the husband is obligated to support his wife to what amount of money? Not $1 million a week. So he'll say, if the Bezdin will determine that I'm acting improperly, so I obligate myself to give $1,500 a week as support for my wife. So that'll encourage him to give the get. He'll shake a leg, give the get in due time. On the side of Maimonides, on the side of the text of the Rambam, we have different commentaries. So one of the commentaries from the 1500s has a fascinating, in the 10th of the sources, the Radvaz has a fascinating statement. The Rambam writes, Maimonides writes, that if a person admits that he violated a sin for which he deserves the death penalty, so we don't give him the death penalty. A person admits that he violated a sin for which he deserves to be whipped, so we don't whip him. If a person admits that he owes money, so we tell him you got to pay the money. He says, I robbed the bank, $1 million, so you got to pay the $1 million. But if he admits that he did he violated some sin for which he deserves physical punishment, so we don't accept what he said. Why not? So the Radvaz writes in his commentary on the Rambam that a person doesn't own his own body, he doesn't own his own soul. As the Navi, as the prophet Yechezkel writes, Hanushamas Lihain, God says, all the souls of the human beings belong to me. I own all the people's bodies. We say in the Slichas, Hanushamalach Vagub Shalach, my soul belongs to God and my body belongs to God. So since I own my money, I own my suit, I own my apartment, but I don't own my body. The clothing on my body belongs to me, but the body and the soul do not belong to me. A person has no right to take his life, to commit suicide. A person has no right to inflict any harm on his body. Not only am I not permitted to beat someone else up, I'm not allowed to injure myself. Also, l'adam lachbol biatzmo. So this became a famous passage in the Radvaz, famous in the sense, years ago there was a prominent rabbi in Eretz Yisrael known as Rabbi Zevin. And he used to write for the Mizrahi newspaper every week, Hatzofet. I don't think it exists anymore, Hatzofet. He went out of business, I think. So he used to write, so most of the time, for years and years, most of the time he would write book reviews on a new sefer that came out. Sometimes he would rip the sefer apart, saying the guy doesn't know what he's talking about. Sometimes he would praise the sefer. He wrote book reviews. And then when he wasn't writing book reviews, he would write essays on Parshas Lech Lecha, an essay on Parshas Vayera, on the Akedah, an essay on the Shira Sayam, an essay on Maimon Hasina, essays on Torah topics. So one of his essays is entitled Mishpat Shylock. What does the Jewish law have to say about the story with Shylock? Shylock made the other person agree that in case he doesn't pay back the money, he has to give him a pound of flesh. So does a person own his body that he has the ability to obligate himself to give a pound of flesh? So Rabbi Zevin published a whole essay about this that became very famous. Mishpat Shylock. So he says, according to Jewish law, he quotes this passage from the Radvaz and many other sources, he says, according to Jewish law, a person does not own his body, he does not own his soul, he owns his property, but he doesn't own his own body. Nonetheless, even though we assume like that, a person does not own his body, the Rambam, Maimonides, has different sections in his halachic work. So he has one section about the laws of shutvim, the laws of partnership. So he says, let's say two shoemakers want to go into a partnership together. I have a store where I fix shoes, and you have a store. Your store is in Borough Park, and my store is in Muncie. We don't know in advance. I may have a very good year. You may have a very good year. We don't know who's going to make a lot of money. So between the two of us, we think we'll probably do well. But we don't know who's going to do well. So let's say two individuals going to Shutfus together. You should own half of my salary. I should own half of your salary. Is there any way to make such a legally binding agreement that we should be Shutfim to share 50-50 all the salary? So if I'll make $200,000 a year, you'll make $100,000 a year, so come, we both made $150,000. We'll share equally what each one of us made. So Maimonides writes that there's no way to make such a legally binding partnership. You didn't earn the money yet. How can you give over ownership of half of the money if you did, at the beginning of the year, you didn't acquire the money yet? That's a davar shelo li'olam. I don't have it yet, so I can't give over half of it to the other fellow. So there's no such thing. No such thing as a legally binding agreement to become shutfim like that. There's a different kind of partnership. If you have the brains and I have the money, so I'm going to give you $100,000 and you should use your brains to invest and do whatever, and then we're going to split 50-50. So that's a partnership. I gave you all the money, so I should be entitled to get all the profit. And I agree, because of the work that you're doing, you're using your brains to invest it or to make a shop or a store, to do all the work, so you should get 50%. Or I'll get 25%, you'll get 75%, whatever the agreement is. That's a different kind of partnership. But a partnership for two people, they're both shoemakers, or they're both or whatever Indian chiefs, and they agree to split the salary in half, so how can you split? So there's no such thing. There's no such thing as such a partnership. So the Ravid has running comments on the Rambam. He disagrees. He says, Omar Avraham, the Ravid says the Rambam is wrong. He says a person owns himself, a person has the ability to sell himself as a slave. There's an institution in the Chumash of an Eved Ivri. The Talmud says that the laws of Eved Ivri don't apply today. You can't sell yourself as a Jewish slave today because the Yovel doesn't exist. We don't observe the Jubilee year anymore. And the Torah tells us, the Chumash says, that if a person is a Jewish slave, at the end of 6 years he goes free, maximum 6 years, not more. And then even if the Jubilee year, Yom Kippur of the Jubilee year comes within the 6 years, then he goes free when it comes Shnas HaYovel. So the Talmud derives from the way the Chumash, the way the Bible describes it, only when the Jubilee year is observed is it possible to own an Eved Ivri, a Jewish slave. When the laws of the Yovel year, the Jubilee year, don't apply anymore, so the whole institution of a Jewish slave doesn't exist. So now, we haven't been observing the law of Yovel. Every 70th year is a Shbita year, is a sabbatical year. But after 7 times 7, the 50th year is a Jubilee year. That we haven't had for many, many centuries, because the Talmud points out, based on the verse in the Bible, the laws of Yovel, the laws of the Jubilee year, only apply when the majority of the Jewish population lives in Eretz Yisrael. That's the pasuk that appears on the Liberty Bell. I was brought up in Philadelphia. So the Liberty Bell says, I now shall proclaim liberty throughout the land and to all its inhabitants. That's the pasuk. So that what is the... Across from Dror Boris L'chol Yeshua, thou shalt proclaim liberty throughout the land and to all its inhabitants. What do you mean to all its inhabitants? So the Talmud understands that verse to mean, when all the Jews are supposed to be living in Eretz Yisrael, if all the Jews live there, the majority of the Jewish population lives there, 51% of the world Jewish population lives there, then the laws of Yovel, the laws of the Jubilee year apply. And it's already many, many centuries after the destruction of the first temple, so the majority of the Jewish population has not been living in Israel since then. That's over 2,500 years. It's a long time already. So since then, the laws of Jubilee year have not been observed. The laws of Shemitah are observed, but the laws of Jubilee are not observed. So therefore, today we cannot have an Eved Ivri. You can't have a Jew sell himself as a slave to someone else. But in principle, the fact, the Ravid writes in his commentary, the fact that I have the ability to sell myself as a Jewish slave indicates that I own myself. So the Ravid writes, I own myself. So I don't have, let's say, in this year, I'll make $200,000, you'll make $100,000. You don't have to say, I'm making a kinyan, I'm giving you ownership of half of my salary. I didn't acquire the ownership of my salary yet. You didn't acquire your salary yet. So the Rambam is right. My man is right. I can't give over ownership of half of my salary. I don't have the salary yet, but I can give you over ownership of half of me. I own myself. So I make you a partner for the next year. We should be partners. You own half of me and you sell me. I should own half of you. So whatever money I earn will be split 50-50 because you own half of me, and I own half of you. So that you can sell yourself. That's what the Rebbe writes, you can sell yourself. So this doesn't really contradict what we said before. We said the Radvaz writes, and Rabbi Zevin had this whole famous essay, Mishpat Shylock, that a person does not own his body. A person does not own his body, but a person owns his body with respect to the right to make a living. That he does own. A person can sell himself as a slave, as a Jewish person, can sell himself as a slave, because he doesn't own his body, period. Our body, our soul, belongs to God, but we own our body with respect to the right to make money. So therefore, the Rebbe writes, just like I have the ability to sell myself as a slave is going to earn a lot of money. So he owns himself before he sells himself. I own myself with respect to the right to make a living. So therefore I can sell that ownership to you. You should own me with respect to having the right to make money on me. So that's what the Rabbanim 150 years ago came up with this idea. They said, biblically you can only have ownership on a tangible object, either on real estate, on karka, or on metaltalim. I can own an automobile, I can own a television, I can own a bookcase, I can own clothing. Biblically, there's no such thing as owning an intangible. I own the idea. No such thing as owning an idea. It's not a tangible object. But the world is going to collapse. Everybody's going to steal everybody else's ideas. You have to have something like copyright laws. So the rabbis 150 years ago said, you have to declare that rabbinically, there is ownership on ideas also. But ownership on the idea is only if I'm interested in making money on the idea. So if I came up with this new system to use on the computer, or I made a whole combination of different nigunim, and I made a tape, I made a CD or something. So I own that whole chiddush, the whole thing that I created. Whoever creates something owns that. Whoever creates an idea, comes up with an idea, owns the idea. What do you mean he owns the idea? He owns the idea with respect to the right to make money on it. So if the fella came up with some idea on the computer, he prints a book or something, he says, I'm not interested in making money. I don't want anybody else to make money on it either. So we don't say, it's not like I own all the furniture in my house. Even the 20 chairs, I won't even realize that they're missing. You're not allowed to steal the chairs. I own the tangible object, I own the chairs. So that's Gnevi, you're not allowed to take it. But when you say that rabbinically I own the ideas, intangible object, I own the idea means I own the idea with respect to the right to make money on it. If I'm not interested in making money, so then I have the right to say, I don't want anybody else to use this niggin. I don't want anybody else to use this idea either. That not. And I only own the right to the idea, the right to make money. Let's say I put out a tape, a collection of different songs. And the tape, I'm selling in the store for $25. And you enjoy some of the songs. You would never ever pay $25 for a tape. You can't afford it. It's out of the question. So you are not a potential customer. So you don't say, I own the ideas that I came up with, the nigunim, with respect to, no one else should be able to get pleasure from my tape. I have no right to say that. If you are a potential customer, you would pay $25 for the tape, but if you get it for nothing, you'd be happier. You'd like to get it for nothing. So you're going to make a copy of the tape that someone else bought. So there I say, since I was the one who came up with this collection of nigunim, I have the right to make money on it, and you are a potential customer. You would have paid $25, not unreasonable, you're wealthy enough, so you're not allowed to cheat me, you're not allowed to steal. Let's say I put out a book, and I have copies of the book left. It's available for purchase. And you would be interested in buying the book. If you can get it for nothing, you'd be happier. Why should you pay $25 for a book and get it for nothing? So you're going to take it out from the library and make a Xerox copy. So that's based on the copyright laws. We say, Midrabanan, you own the right to these ideas that you have in the book, that no one's allowed to cheat you. Since he's a potential customer, he would have been willing to pay the $25 for the book. He's not allowed to cheat you and make a Xerox copy of the whole book for himself. But if he's not, it's lo bo b'cheshbon. It's not worth it to him. He only needs one page in the book. He's not interested. He would never pay $25 for the whole book. He only needs one page in one chapter or something. So if the fellow's not a potential customer, then you don't say that the ideas that I developed in the book belong to me, and no one's allowed to be nana, and no one's allowed to use it. That's not so. It's only I own the idea, rabbinically, I own the idea with respect to the right to make money on it, like the Rebbe says, that a person owns his body, doesn't own his body, owns his body with respect to the right to make money on it. So the same over here. This was the idea that was developed by the G'dolim in the middle of the 1800s. They said, The halacha has to recognize the idea of a copyright based on this idea. Whoever creates something, if he creates a tangible thing, he plants something in the ground and it grows, or the fellow builds a hotel on the other guy's field, so there's something tangible there. So I created the shvach, I created this improvement, something new that wasn't there before, so there literally there's ownership on the bien. If I read you a shidduch and you're happily married, you don't have to pay me anything. But if I improved something, I made something that wasn't there before, so then I become a shutif. That thing that I created belongs to me. And in this area, if it's not a tangible object, so rabbinically we say that the one who created this new idea, the new system on the computer, or the new niggun, or the book, whatever he came out with, he owns it only with respect to the right to make money. Now we live... Let's say someone works for IBM, and they're salaried, and they come up with chidushim. I have a daughter who works for IBM. I think she has 35 patents on different things. She's a big genius. So who has the right to make the money? So who has the right to all of the money? She was salaried by IBM to make all of these, to develop all of these ideas. So let's say if I have a slave, I have an eved. So the rule is, anything that my slave acquires ownership of, he gets a job, he earns money, the money goes to me. He's walking in the street, he picks up $1,000 bill, $1,000 belongs to me. Anything my slave acquires ownership of belongs to the master. The master owns it. What happens if I have an employee? A guy works for me from 9 to 5 every day in my office. He's walking in the street on his way home at 5:30, and he finds $1,000 bill. So $1,000 bill belongs to me. No. Let's say he's out on his lunch break. He went out for fresh air, whatever. In the middle of, he works from 9 to 5, and then he's walking in the street between 9 and 5, and he finds $1,000 bill in the street. Also doesn't belong to me. He's my employee to work on the computer. He's not my employee that everything he does belongs to me. What if I hire a person, I say, I want you to work to me, I want you to work for me from 9 to 5, I'll pay you so much money, and I will tell you later, whatever you do, whatever is of value, whatever is worth money, I want you to do that for me. I might ask you to dig ditches, I may ask you to look on the beach in order to find valuable pearls or something, I may ask you to go look for a shipwreck to discover things. Any way where you can earn money should belong to me. So in a certain sense, he's my slave. Between 9 and 5, I said, I want you to work maybe between 9 and 5, miscellaneous work, anything that's of value. So then the Talmud says, if he picks up a mitzvah, if he picks up a $500 bill in the street, then it belongs to the employee, to the employer. It doesn't belong to him. If you work for me 9 to 5, you work in my company, so your job is limited. We made up in advance, but your job, you're a secretary or something, you're a bookkeeper. That's all you have to do is a secretary or bookkeeper. But if I say, I want you to work 9 to 5, whatever, whatever I'll come up with, whatever is going to be of value, you should belong to me, I have the right to ask you to do the work. So then if you find a $1,000 bill between 9 and 5, then it belongs to the other fellow. So the same is true if IBM hires someone, and they say, my daughter works for the think tank, IBM. Think tank, they pay her money to think and to come up with chidushim. So whatever idea she comes up with belongs to IBM because they hired her. She's not a slave. If she'll find a $1,000 bill in the street, that belongs to her. They didn't hire her for anything and everything. They hired her to think and to come up with big chidushim, with original ideas. Any idea that she comes up with that's of value that you can make money on, so with respect to that, it belongs to IBM. So I was telling Rabbi Kahn on the phone the other day that... several years ago, recently, Art Scroll has the whole Talmud translated into English, has the whole Talmud translated into Hebrew. And they charge a lot of money to buy these volumes. Some wise guy took every single page of the Art Scroll Talmud and put it on the internet, available to the public, so whoever wants can print it, take it off of the internet. So we're going to lose a fortune of money. It's open to the public, whoever wants. So the volumes that the character used to make copies of were all printed. It said it was from a lending library in Yerushalayim. So the people from Art Scroll went to the librarian and they asked him, who was the wise guy who took out all of the volumes of Art Scroll and put it on the internet? So he said, he can't tell them it's Mesira. you're not allowed to tell on another Jew that he should be arrested by the government. He said, what do you mean? The Israeli government? The Israeli government. It's not a Goyish government. The guy is a Ganef, the Israeli government wants to catch the Ganef. So the librarian said, he thinks I'm not allowed to snitch to the police. So Rabbi Yashiv was still alive at that time, so they had to wait a couple of days till they got him to speak to Rabbi Yashiv. Rabbi Yashiv said, it's not the Sirah. The police should put him in jail. So finally, the librarian finally said who it was, and they caught the guy and they stopped it. So they were afraid. Artskol was afraid, before it took everything off of the internet, he was afraid everybody's going to print out copies of the Artskol Gemara. They'll lose thousands of dollars of revenue selling the volumes. So they wanted all the Rabbanim in the world to publish that it's prohibited to download copies of the Talmud. So they wanted Hasidish and Misnagdish and from these yeshivas, from those, they wanted everybody, all the groups of Jews should be represented to say that they're not allowed to. So one of the Rabbanim wrote an essay outlining this whole argument. The Rab Chaim Soloveitchik writes in his commentary on the Rambam that whoever makes some improvement acquires ownership of the thing. That's if a tangible improvement. And if it's idea, like the art scroll, they developed this new translation and the whole commentary, so it belongs to the world of ideas, and it's not a tangible shvach bien. So midrabbanan, it's rabbinically considered he's the owner of the thing. And if art scroll salaried the people who did the translation, so art scroll is the owner. So it's a geneva from art scroll if you're going to make copies of the Talmud that was put on the internet. This is the background, this is the basis of this whole Chiddush that the Rabbanim in the 1800s came up with this, the middle of the 1800s came up with this, that we have to adopt this concept of copyright that the secular world has based on this idea that whoever comes up with an invention and he has a patent, or the person comes up with a copyright on a book or on a CD, whatever, and he has the right to make money on it, so we declare he's the owner of the idea. There's such a concept, midrabbanan, is owning an idea with respect to you have the right to make money on this idea. Thank you.